And go.
All right, welcome back in for another episode of the Scenario Sports. I'm your host, Matt Whitener. You can see on the other side of the screen, we've got my usual cohort in the regular scenario. Is it the regular scenario or is it just the scenario? I don't
know how you put it. Point, we got so many shows. It's like having a Bonneville versus having a 98. So whatever.
Well, Daryl Fryson's here as well. When he shows up at the beginning of the show, you have to already understand that it's going to be a dose of sports ratchetry. It's going to start up front. But before we get into that, you know, definitely I want to just thank everybody for checking out, coming back over. New year, we dropped a couple shows at the end of last year, but we're going to get it rolling on a regular basis this year. We'll work out the day that we're going to have this on. I'm thinking it's going to be an end of the week thing, but we got a lot going on here at SOLC right now. So it's kind of, you know, I want to give everybody else their chance to get there. I'll figure out a way for myself to get in there. Just like Dale's found our way to get Mike Check in there, you know. So we just, you know, we get ourselves in there as needed. But again, thanks for coming and checking it out. We're going to have a lot of things today. Jason Klinkscales is going to come back on again. He's been on a couple of times already in the past. We're going to touch on a number of different things, the dynamics of the James Harden deal, just kind of what that looks like, what that really means, you know, outside of just, oh, wow, look, the Nets have got some talent on their side. But some of the things that went into that, what that could mean down the road. Also take a look at the, I don't want to say stunning, stunning is the wrong word, but just the fact of the matter is this is an absolute lack of melanin in the NFL coaching searches this year. And we got to digest that and talk about what that means and why it really doesn't surprise me or Jason at all. And finally, we're also going to touch on Deshaun Watson, who's taking the power into his hands in a way that you usually don't see in the NFL. You know, he's got a lot of chips in his favor and taking the power in his hands versus the Houston Texans right now. Oh, and also a little bit of conversation about the baseball, of all places, is driving the minority conversation right now, what's going on in sports. So, all of that and more. Again, we'll get to that in a second, coming up on the later half of the show. But before we get into anything else, I know you got something that you got to get off of your chest.
Yeah, so I haven't had a chance to really gloat of my number 7th ranked Iowa State Cyclones in the last two polls. Fiesta Bowl winners as well. Shout out to them. Everybody's coming back. Our coach didn't leave us at the altar as of right now. He's always looking for another chick. So we're just happy that he's happy with the girl he went to high school with.
So that's can who I we tell are. You, can I tell you that everything was looking good for that until yesterday?
What do you mean? What happened yesterday?
Well, and I don't know if you saw it yesterday, but Tennessee had to let their coach go.
I don't like this sport
because they were stuffing money in McDonald's bags and giving it to recruits.
But no, he got offered the Tennessee job before and he turned it down.
Hey, I'm just telling you.
Look, I'm not worried about Tennessee. I'm only worried about three schools and an NFL job. Now, if the Tennessee Titans came open, I'd be like, oh man, we finna. Melissa Ford and walked in the club. And we
see the Titans offensive coordinator job is open.
No, he ain't gonna do that. No. He got too in Tennessee, like, okay, yeah. You gotta think Iowa State, they just upped him for more money and all his assistants. Are you gonna go to SEC and get dog stomped by Florida, Georgia, maybe Mizzou, Alabama, A&M, Auburn?
Here's the thing I'll say.
Seven losses right there.
Here's the thing I'll say about Tennessee though up front is that they've been playing like they on a McDonald's budget of late. They need to be sticking some of them dollars into like a Chick-fil-A bag at least, or like a Five Guys bag. You know what I'm saying?
You know what? Tennessee, I think, suffers from almost a extent that they thought they were a blue blood. I think they move like they think they are, but they really not.
Well, they're a team that had a great run, but they aren't like a traditional powerhouse. And it was a long run, you know what I mean? You know, from Peyton Manning all the way into T. Martin and all the stuff that they did there, Jamal Lewis, like, you know, shout out tons of dope players came out of Tennessee. But they just haven't been able to get their feet underneath them. And you don't get a lot of time for that in the SEC. Like, if you don't stay on top of it, you're going to fall off the top.
Right. So why go there? Why go there?
I mean, it's a big check, and it's, I hate to say it, the rest of the country hates this. It's the SEC.
Right. But I'm only going to SEC unless I'm going to be at one of the top jobs. I'm not going to Vanderbilt. You know what I'm saying? Hey, like,
go to Vanderbilt. it's and more people putting eyes on the opportunities there. Look at what happens with what's his name? Took the job at Kentucky, had a couple of good years, got a check out of it. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, we got checks. We ain't worried about that. We got checks. Only jobs I'm worried him about is Michigan, Ohio State, Notre Dame, and an NFL job. Those are the places like he's got like people with, and he's from the Midwest.
Well, don't worry about Michigan because apparently, Harbaugh has got the nudes or something like that.
Harbaugh is running like a white man for real. Like the supreme level of white privilege is Jim Harbaugh.
It's got to be something like that.
No, it's got to be. If his name was Jameis Harbaugh, he would have been fired 2 years ago. Well,
first of all, he would have been at Michigan State, not Michigan. That's a whole nother thing.
What was the black coach at Michigan State football wise that was there for a little bit when we was in college? What was his? You know what I'm talking about?
I can envision him.
He looked like he was like your uncle. Like, yeah. I remember that he looked like an uncle.
Yeah. That doesn't work out too good. Looking like an uncle, looking like a black uncle, isn't working out too good.
He actually looked like the bizarre world of Tyrone Willingham.
Oh wow,
he's the bizarre version of Tyrone.
Now I'm picturing Ron Washington from the Rangers.
But yeah, that's it. That's what I'm thinking. He's the drunk uncle, like they're brothers. He was the one that went to college. He's the other one that went to jail.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Because Todd looks like he went to Stanford. Like he looked like he went to Stanford. Like they just cut him off the press line.
Shout out to Stanford forever, man. Two black coaches in my lifetime. That's just incredible. You don't see too many places that happens at. Speaking of things that you don't see too often, we're recording this on Wednesday evening after the inauguration. So the last 2 days, well, in the last already this week, we've had MLK Day and we've had the inauguration, which was, I don't know, man. It was absolutely one of the blackest. I don't want to say accidentally black, but it had a whole lot to it. It had more flavor. It was like going to like a soul food buffet, but they had tacos. And then they also had like some white people stuff too, whatever they got, hot dogs, apple, or whatever that is. But going back to the beginning of the week, MLK Day is the unofficial NBA holiday, as it should be, right? Mm-hmm. But I was sitting here watching the game, the Hawks. The Hawks played who did the Hawks play? The Pacers? I can't remember. The Hawks played the Hawks game, and I looked at it. And I had to wipe my eyes because I was real confused when I looked at the hat and when I looked at the logo, and they had a stained glass Atlanta Hawks logo at half court. I was just like, hold up, this is like another level of embracing the culture. But I quickly, and then on their jerseys, they had the city edition jerseys that just had MLK on it. For the Hawks, I was like, this is the blackest thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, it was so black that I looked at Kevin Huerter, who's the guard on the Hawks, a white guy, and I was just like, man, he looks like when the one white dude be on the line with the fraternity, and you'd be like, oh, damn, they got a white dude, too. Because I think he's the only white dude on the Hawks. Wow, because right now, I don't think that Bogdanovic or Danilo Gallinari is playing. So I think he is the sole representation right now. And then they got the Spanish Harlem looking cat in Trey Young.
Not the Spanish Harlem, Ice Trey. Shout out to Ice Trey.
But it got me thinking, like, who should be the teams that are allowed to play on MLK Day? Like, I feel like there's some cities I don't want to see represented playing in the five games that they have on MLK Day.
I mean, this goes back to our NFL Black Cities thing. It's pretty much going to be the same ones. Chicago needs to play Detroit. That needs to happen.
Okay, so Bulls, Pistons.
Philly, New York.
Sixers and Knicks.
We can do Sixers. Ooh, that's a good one. Can they do a round robin?
I feel like Atlanta absolutely has to be in there, but Atlanta should have to play Memphis every year.
Oh yes,
like Atlanta.
Yeah, because he's from Memphis. Atlanta, and then he died in Memphis.
Every you should just Atlanta and Memphis should play every year.
Houston, Dallas got to play every year on MLK.
But see, we're running out of games though already. Like, see, now we're running out of like Charlotte. Charlotte needs to have a game.
Nah, the Charlotte need a game.
Charlotte needs.
You
talking about
you want the blackest? You talking about you want black?
But Charlotte has a black staple that their city is represented on, and that's barbecue. So if you got a barbecue city, you should be considered for representation on MLK Day.
Who does Charlotte play though? Miami.
I mean, New Orleans should get a game.
Yeah. So Charlotte. Ooh, the battle for Hornet. The Hornet.
Maybe somewhere that's covertly black, like Milwaukee. Mm. you gotta represent for the brothers out west. Maybe you gotta work the Warriors moved to San Francisco though.
Different thing. It's not now you can go real ill and do Utah versus Detroit and just have a race war.
No, see, that's what I'm saying. That's the other side of this. The teams that never need to play on MLK.
Utah, Portland.
Yep, thank you. Utah, Portland. Who else am I missing here? I'm missing some. See, Phoenix. I don't think Phoenix needs to be playing. San Antonio. That's a different holiday. Yeah, that's a different holiday.
You can really stretch if you want to stretch it. Sacramento don't need to be playing either.
Yeah, Sacramento don't need to be in there. I've been to Sacramento once, and it felt like going to West Utah.
Yep.
And then I guess the last one that I got to ban out, man, is let's see. Who else doesn't have a place that day? I'm just going to say it, man. Orlando? The Magic shouldn't be playing, dog. Sorry. Not on MLK Day. Not on MLK Day. How many brothers you know from Orlando, Florida?
But why not? Why shouldn't they be playing?
But what's the most significant black event that Orlando's ever been around?
What, Black Beach Week?
See? That's not enough.
And that's Daytona, I think, technically.
Exactly. See? We got nothing. Orlando can't play on MLK Day either. But the other thing that stood out to me, and this is where I wanted to enlist your mind at, because I feel like this falls into your wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. The jersey. So, like the MLK on the Atlanta jersey is dope. Like, it's a dope-looking jersey. I guarantee you it's sold out if you go and try to grab that on NBA.com right now. But some of these other cities, if we're going to have them in, like, what's their black-centric thing that needs to be featured on their jersey? Like, what's that Afrocentric thing you'd be like, you know what? I see it.
I'm going to go with, first off, the Brooklyn Biggies.
So, like, what's that –
It's Biggie. It's Biggie slam dunking like Jordan on the jersey. So instead of like the Jordan imprint, it's Biggie big ass dunking with the Coogee sweater on and Tim's.
So you got Zion Williamson on the front of the Nets jersey.
Yep. All right. Yep. Well, he got to have a Coogee sweater and a Coogee hat on.
Yeah, that's true. It needs to be matching. I thought again. You know, hey, I want a slab of ribs on the front of that Charlotte jersey.
The Memphis 3-6.
All right. Put 3-6 Mafia on the front of that joint?
No, just the 3-6. Like the 3 and the 6 together, kind of like what they got on their logo, like for the 3-6 Mafia logo.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Yeah, yeah. Represent. Like it's everything inferred in that, like in one thing right there. All right. And one more. Detroit. What are we putting on the front of Detroit's?
The Big Meeches.
Oh, damn. Damn.
Atlanta? Like, does who gets Big Meech? Does Atlanta get Big Meech?
Atlanta's got MLK. Okay. Detroit should get Detroit Red.
But Malcolm X never lived in Detroit. That's the thing. They just called him Detroit Red.
I know, but that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. Just put Detroit Red on there, and then people will be like, oh, okay.
He did live in Detroit. I take that back. He did, but it was a brief period.
Yeah, it wasn't enough
Boston
to be like
– Does Boston go on there with Malcolm X? Because he lived in Boston right before.
Boston, actually, I'm sorry. We forgot about Boston. Boston cannot play on MLK Day.
Yeah.
No.
But on St. Patrick's Day, Boston could play Utah, right?
Yeah, that's fine. I think that should be – yeah, I think that should absolutely be reserved for that type of spirit. Yeah.
All right, I'm trying to think of some other cities. Chicago, is it the Jordans or the Vice Lords?
Well, Jordan's already in the front of every jersey as is.
So is it the Vice Lords or the Folks?
Oh man, I was gonna say had that Harold's Chicken running across that joint.
Ooh, that's a good one. The Harold's.
You know how quickly I would buy a Chicago Bulls jersey inspired by Harold's Chicken?
Oh, you know it's a Harold's Chicken coming on Union.
I'm aware of that. I sent you that thing because
Yeah,
I
you
felt like
did.
that was I've been watching a lot of CNN recently, and that breaking news, like now, like how everything's breaking news on CNN, which first of all, is false flagging like a mug.
It is. Because and it's so messed up because we're used to like seeing that when 9/11 happened to something like where you like, oh snap, like something real
right.
big has happened. Like they get
yeah,
you
it's
because we're still got that mind state of like when our president died or something like that
it's
happened.
It's not breaking news. Joe Biden is tying his shoe before it. Like, no, that's not it. But
John Bon Jovi performing is not breaking news.
That's not breaking news, but it's been breaking news on CNN since like 7:30 this morning. Like, and he just performed like an hour ago. I was like, all right, guys, you're stretching it. All right, man. But speaking of the inauguration, if you got some ideas about those inspired NBA jerseys, let us know. Let us know what needs to be featured on there. We might actually get a couple of those worked up so we can show what that looks like and get that out there and make some recommendations. We'll get Keith Robinson back on here and be like, Keith, we need to get some recommendations
the
out
ca-
there.
The New Orleans Cash Monies.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. I just want like the silhouette.
Or does the Tank go on there, or does Cash Money go on New Orleans? Before we even go to the next segment, that is a good. That is a big question.
For me, it's the Tank always.
I mean, right, but I'm saying to better jersey, like what, like for, encompassing. Which one do you think would be the better look for the jersey? Personal thoughts aside,
the Tank.
The Tank. Okay.
You know how dope a Tank would look? You could
That's
make
true.
Like a camouflage Pelicans jersey or something like that. Have the Pelican coming out the top of the Tank.
What did they have on in Make Them Say videos with make this with let them wear those?
They was wearing like full camouflages. Like they would
let them wear
out.
Those. Let them wear this Make Them Say jerseys.
Oh man, that'd be a tough game right there. Zion already don't want to play 30 minutes a night, let alone have to play in some camos. But
playing the Charlotte ribs, we said earlier.
Eating the Charlotte ribs. All right, man. Well, before we get into the to have Jason on, man, I wanted to definitely talk about what I saw today at the inauguration. It just blew my mind. Like, I didn't expect to have any sports connotation in the inauguration or anything like that. But you ever been somewhere and you see somebody and you're just like, yo, what the hell are you doing here?
Yep, for sure.
And you'd be like, oh, for real? Oh, word? I didn't know that you, okay, that's what's up. I didn't know you knew, you know, whoever like that. Oh, damn, all right, cool, that's what's up. Well, I'm going to holler at you. That's the moment that one Barack Obama had today when he had just after being introduced and coming out for the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, was saying hello to people walking around on the balcony out there. I'm sure there's a fancier word for that I'm not aware of what it actually is. But you dapping up people moving past, and then you see none other than Alex Rodriguez. And I gotta go back and watch the tape again, because I feel like in that moment, Obama like just did the dap and kept rolling, but then rolled back like, yo, like
what?
Like
he had to
like,
think about it for a second.
Like,
here? Hold on, is that A-Rod here?
Yeah, and then like he was rapping with him for a second, like talking with him for a second, and then at the end, after because obviously A-Rod was there to support his fiance. Are they married? Fiance? What is it?
I don't know
like
what they are. They're together. That's it.
Jennifer Lopez though, who performed, and we'll definitely talk about that on Scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some thoughts. Jennifer Lopez performed, and so A-Rod was there, you know, just like Rosario Dawson was there with Cory Booker. Like, it was like a interesting collision of people at this thing. But it got me thinking, has Alex Rodriguez had one of the most miraculous turnarounds ever, like of any circle of all time?
I almost say he's had one of the best lives. Period. If you look at his
for sure. He's got that because he made $500 million playing baseball.
Yeah.
But like he was excommunicated from baseball for like a year and a half. And
came
now
back and played what, another year and a half, 2 years?
Well, yeah, he played that contract through. He played every year except for the last year of that contract when they just wrote him a check and was like, all right, man. All right,
we could buy you out.
Yeah, now it's not just completely terrible money anymore. You gotta go.
You're 41 years old now.
But he's there's a chance that he might not make the Baseball Hall of Fame, but made it on stage for the inauguration of the President of the United States.
And he's got to be the Is he the first baseball player of color to be there on the main stage?
Who knows? I would maybe that was the All-Star game. I know that Willie Mays rode to the All-Star game with Obama. But
I mean, sitting up there like on main stage, he may be the first.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not a presidential inaugurationist.
And what's the thing is, though, somebody knows this. Somebody in the comments jump in and tell us. Somebody knows, and somebody is a historian of inaugural baseball, basketball, football players that have sat in the front on the main stage.
I'm going to go with my mind and I'm going to say no. But at any rate, the thing about it is this an accomplishment or is this the ultimate finesse?
I think it's ultimate finesse. The fact that he's even with J-Lo, period, is a finesse in itself before we even get to the inauguration. And that's just a connection. That's just a segue to him being at the inauguration was the fact that he's with J-Lo.
Yes.
If you told me what they've been together maybe 5 years. They've been together about 5 years.
It feels like it. Who knows?
But whatever time period right before they got together, I'm talking about a week before they got together. If you told me that this was going to be A-Rod's sequence of events of his next part of his life, being on Shark Tank as this big businessman, almost buying the Mets, and now he's sitting there with Barack Obama double taking him, like, why are you here? That's an amazing run.
Chopping it up with Barack and Michelle after Biden got it, I don't know. I've never seen anything like the resurrection of Alex Rodriguez in my life. So
Mike Tyson might be up there.
I don't know. Mike Tyson wasn't at the inauguration of the president of the United States.
That's true.
Like Derek Jeter wasn't even there.
But Mike Tyson went to jail.
That's
a hell of a way to dig yourself out of a hole from going to jail.
Yeah, true. I mean, there's a lot of people that
success isn't the end, is the distance traveled.
it's a hell of a finesse when you end up being at the inauguration of the President of the United States, but you might not be able to get into the Hall of Fame.
Isn't this old lady a great finesser as well?
That's a conversation that's going to segue into the scenario.
So they're both finessers. That's why they're great together.
It might be one of the great finesse relationships of all time, but we're going to talk about that on the scenario. We're going to get over to Jason Klinkscales now and chop things up with him about that. D, I know we'll be getting to we'll be having a
yeah. Y'all better have real smart talk, man. Y'all have real smart talk coming up in a second. Smart talk.
Yeah, man. It's going to be a different situation than this. I'll let you know that we recorded this one, that segment before this one. But all topics still relevant there. So enjoy this conversation with myself and the always esteemed Jason Klinkscale.
All right, and welcome back. We're going to keep things rolling with the sports scenario here. And welcome back for the third time, I think.
Yeah, I feel like it's the third, maybe the fourth. Who knows?
Third time, the third of many. Jason Klinkscales is with us here again from the great state of New York. Jason, what's going on, brother?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
I can't complain, man. Who would listen? It's too many other people doing it.
Ain't that the truth?
So I wanted to get Jason on here because there's been some things that me and him have been chatting about offline that just, you know, it got my interest and it got to the point where I said, you know what, fine, let's just save it. Talk about this on air. The first of which being is that if I said Houston, we have a problem there, it would be too cliche. So I won't do that. We'll turn it around. There's some problems going on in Houston, Texas.
I like that better.
And I'm going to point out to you when I realize the extent of this. So I realized that last week that James Harden got traded at the exact same moment that Donald Trump got impeached for the second time. And also, maybe a half hour before that, I was watching another channel and Deshaun Watson had basically said enough is enough at the same time. And it was just almost like it was a moment of, oh my God, unparalleled. What is happening in the world, in this city type thing right now for Houston? And it's done nothing but get weirder since that time. So first things first, I want to talk about James Harden. I want to talk about what that maneuver looked like, how we think that looks for the Nets going ahead, and just get your thoughts about how that whole thing went down and then, you know, what it looks like going forward.
Yeah, it's funny. So she's not going to appreciate being shouted out at this very moment. But, you know, my wife was like, wait, he got traded? She's not really a sports fan. But the fact that she's like, wait, they just talked about him, and then all of a sudden he's gone. And the trade just happened. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly, your response is very similar to the rest of us in the sports world. Like, we were like, what? It was that any meme and gif you could think of that all came to mind for us. And what was interesting about that move was that, first of all, I've actually been seeing a lot of the feedback from Brooklyn Nets fans and, you know, folks who kind of pay more attention to just the hoop scene in the East more. And it's been very interesting to sort of see folks who've been longtime Nets fans, you know, folks who actually go back to the days in Jersey, who go back to the Kidd and Martin era and all that of the early 2000s. You know, I think there was an instant split where those folks were very much like, hey, I'm going to miss those homegrown guys, if you will. And I heard a lot of that. Because even before the season started, there were you know, when there was rumors about the Nets trying to make a move for him, a lot of those folks were resistant to bringing him on just for the sheer fact that they built something pretty special. Then they added two key pieces over, you know, in the previous offseason with Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant. And his belief with just those two alone, along with the homegrown talent, they can contend for a title, given some time together. So there's that split. And then there's the newer set, the folks who I think, as we've seen over the years, it's less about them following a team and more of them following either narrative or following specific players who are just like, hey, man, let's just see what happens. Just throw all the ish out there and see what happens and the excitement from that. So I thought that was a very interesting sort of reaction locally, because, listen, as a masochistic Knicks fan, it hurts to have begrudgingly given the Nets credit over the years. But I did like how the Nets were building in terms of, you know, Jared Allen, Caris LeVert, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie. I like the players they had. Joe Harris, obviously, you know, plucking him from quote unquote obscurity, but making him like a really strong player in the league. I like what they built. And they did what I think most teams desire to do, which was take a mostly home-built team. Yeah, I don't want to say it's an upgrade of the coaching, but you change the coaching around in the belief that they can get to the next level. You're bringing Durant back after a year-plus layoff of, you know, from his injury. You have Irving, who has shown he can be a really good piece for a championship team. Whether he is the guy is a different question. But they built the way that you would ideally want to see a franchise built. You know, you can add the pieces and pay for those guys to come in on top of what you built. So go ahead.
I want to jump in on that point that you were going there with that about Kyrie Irving. I think it's been a really interesting time for the Nets. And a lot of people were really focusing on Kyrie Irving or James Harden or anything like that. For me, really, the more interesting thing was like, it feels like it's just another chapter in the Nets being the Nets. Yes. You know, if you go back to, oh God, what was it? The summer of the decision and all those things, you know, you had the Nets that were in the middle of that, feeling like they were going to make the big splash and it never happened. You know, I mean, if you go way back in the day, you've even got, you know, the Nets back in the Dr. J days and all those things with that. But then more recently, they've been a team that has not been shy about, we'll switch it up to make it happen. It seems like a long time ago, but D'Angelo Russell was just there in that in that Kyrie Irving seat. I mean, and it seems a long time ago just because it's judging it in Nets years that they've changed it, the scene, that many times. But one thing that they had done, and I think that this kind of speaks to what their fan base might be thinking about, is that regardless who was there, they kind of stuck together and scrapped their way forward, you know? And I think that this team is anything but a scrap forward team now.
Yeah, I mean, and that's sort of the point I was making about, like, the core pieces that they had. In a lot of ways, not that they were to the same talent level or the same trajectory, but they reminded me of the Miami Heat in between the Shaq era and the Heatles era, where because they had, look, you have Dwayne Wade, one of the best to ever play. He was a foundational piece, obviously, franchise player. Mario Chalmers they formed a good defensive backcourt, and obviously Wade provided the offense. You still had Udonis Haslem, a much younger Udonis Haslem, who I think would be playing until we're 90. You know, you had Joel Anthony, who was still kind of decent. you know, even as in the reserve role. But they actually had a couple of sort of core pieces that allowed them to stay in the playoff mix, even if that's all they're going to be, was a lower seed team in the East. Sure. And then when they suddenly flipped that around, they still kept Chalmers. They still kept, you know, they made a couple other changes, but they had a kind of a core there, along with the great coaching of Alex Bolster, you know, later on, but they had a core, and then they made those moves to get LeBron James. They made that move to get Chris Bosh, and then add pieces around that. I thought that's what the Nets were sort of doing in that in-between period over the last couple of years. And so then when they did bring in Irvin and Durant, it felt like, all right, this is going to be it. Obviously, Durant was going to be, you know, redshirted for a year, if you will, missing all of last season because of the injury he suffered.
Pretty nice redshirt at $29 million.
Right, right. But they were able to do that. But yeah, you're right. I think that, and so again, mentioned the guys that were on the team before, you know, the guys that, obviously Dinwiddie's still there, but he's out for the year with the Achilles injury. But the core of the guys they had there allowed them to still build and to be a team that was build a playoff pack in the East. And if they made the right move, maybe they could have gone to the home field, home court advantage, like top four seeds. And the belief that Durant would be enough to keep them over the top. With Harden in the picture, because Irving is not playing right now, because we've already seen, as you sort of leading to Irving being sort of that wild card in terms of his temperament and his play, and Durant still getting his, I mean, his sea legs are pretty good, but he's supposed to be getting his sea legs together right now this early part of the year. Harden, what he does for the team right now is that he gives them a second offensive option, a guy that, even though, yes, they're both starters, but they can actually tussle that late first period, beginning of the second quarter period with them, bring them in to finish the first half, and then really get their gears running in the second half of those guys. He's really, between him and Durant, you know, they can share the offensive load for a significant period because they don't have anybody else that can pick it up right now.
So here's the thing that really stuck out to me. You know, I will admit that I was one of the main people to say is, how does this work? You know, when you think about the three of those guys together and you think about the way that their games work, they're all ball dominant perimeter guys, you know, and there's only so much ball. And even for these three guys, there's only so much perimeter and there's only so many shots to go around. But then I got to thinking about it and I started thinking about James Harden. And one thing about James Harden that I think that is drastically underrated about him, and I think it's due to the style and the way he played in Houston, he's a really, really, really smart basketball player. And he's a guy
frustrating to people when you're watching him, but yeah, he is an incredibly smart player.
He can do so many things, but you saw it you got such a big dose of him in Houston. It was almost like, you know, the thing about too much of a good thing isn't always the best thing to have. And that was really what Harden was. I mean, we've never seen a guy that was a scorer first in the league have the ball that much since Allen Iverson. It's never happened. You know, I mean, and I'm sure there's a ton of statistics about that. They will talk about, you know, the guys that have held the ball the most and what they've meant. The eye test tells me right away that that's the truth. Maybe some of those Kobe Bryant years in the late 2000s before they became a championship team again. I don't know. But after I watched Durant and Harden's first game together, which obviously is not going to be every night, but I started thinking about it. And in a weird way, it's an intersection of the careers of James Harden. You know, he started off as being a guy that was third fiddle in what at that time was a dynamic duo act with Westbrook and with Durant. They were all young and they all were kind of still defining their way, with the exception of KD. I mean, he was from day one. He was that guy.
Yeah.
But then also later on in his career, Harden had the biggest question to ask. It says, how do you play Chris Paul and James Harden together? Now, although that team didn't win, if you will, I mean, they didn't do it all. They absolutely won, but they didn't, you know, win it all. They had the Warriors on the ropes, but the ropes don't get hung from the rafters. Only banners do. And the thing about it is, but I looked at it and I said, well, Harden and Paul coexisted just fine. That made sense from a basketball standpoint. So now he's just kind of in the mix of both. And I think that Harden's basketball IQ and his ability to do everything else, you're going to see waves of different versions of James Harden every night. And I think that they become a matchup, you know, nightmare if Harden is willing to play kind of that sliding role, if you will.
I think the difference with, as I'm listening to you and as I think about this now, let's not forget that part of the reason why Harden is gone in addition to his own, you know, erratic behavior leading into this season. Part of the reason why he was gone is because he was really unhappy with, it was alleged he was happy about Mike D'Antoni leaving, unhappy about Daryl Morey leaving. But let's not forget that D'Antoni is now an assistant under Steve Nash. And I do think that that familiarity of having Harden, for Harden going back to a coach that he just left not that long ago. Not like, you know, it's been a few years. This is like maybe 3-4 months ago.
Right.
But having that familiarity with him, I think, will help a still learning head coach in Steve Nash meld these guys together. Nobody knows James Harden better than Mike D'Antoni on his staff, except for Kevin Durant. And even then, it's been some years since they played together. So no one really knows what Harden can be and what he can do more than D'Antoni. Mm-hmm. D'Antoni now has already had a little bit of experience with Kyrie Irving, a little bit of experience with Kevin Durant. He's had dynamic players before. I think that's going to be the thing that kind of helps see if this fits or not. I think if D'Antoni wasn't there, I don't think Harden's there, to be honest with you. I don't know if the team makes this move, because I think we're going to have these questions for the next 60-plus games. Can they make this work? Can they make this work?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that's one of the three questions I had for you about this. Is this going to work? And if it does work, to what extent?
I don't know if they're going to win. This year, no, they're not winning a title this year. They're not. I don't think it's a slight on them as much as it is the Lakers are Lakers. And unless something really happens that is drastic, and somebody can come back to this point and just say, Jason, you're an idiot. But like, if something happens to anybody on the
bookmark,
Lakers.
Bookmark time.
Right.
Timestamp.
I think it's going to be tough for them to do this, because it is, even though, again, it's not that early in the season at this point. Remember, this is a shortened season with a lot of cancellations, a lot of postponements. This is a very unique season period. So we can't treat this as a normal year.
This is the equivalent of December, I think. I think if you're thinking about regular year, this is about the equivalent of December, it feels like.
It's equivalent of December, but it's also, let's hope that everything improves with the league overall, but like, everything could shut down any moment. Sure. You know, if the league decides to. They can make whatever decision they want. They can end up being, or it could be a situation like, the team doesn't play for a week. I mean, the Celtics just got off of, like, you know, not playing for a week, and then they got smashed by the Knicks yesterday. That kind of thing can happen this year with all these teams because of the COVID protocols and the like. So it's hard to 100% compare it to the same realms of previous seasons or even just the bubble. But at the same time, I do think that because there have been so much drastic changes to the franchise in such a short period of time, and Durant is a transcendent player, first ballot future Hall of Famer, can win anybody anything, right?
Top 20 all-time guy. I mean, that's a different type of ball player.
No question. Harden and Irving, you know, for as great as he was for his spurts with the Cavs title run, Irving wasn't the guy. Irving needed LeBron. He needed Kevin Love. He needed all these other people. And then they let him do his work. Mm-hmm. Harden is somewhat in that same boat. He hasn't fully led a team out of the conference finals just yet. So I think that's my hesitance. It's not that they can't do it. I just don't think they can do it this season because it's such an unpredictable year, and because things can shut down, and trying to get that chemistry together, especially with a new first-time head coach and a whole different, you know, coaching staff. Like, I think there's so many changes there that it's hard to say, you know, despite the transcendence of Kevin Durant, that this team can do it and do it this year. Now, could they do it next year? Maybe, because maybe they can add another piece that could help them out in terms of depth.
And here's the thing I'll say real quick about next year is that in a year with Giannis leaving the free agent waters via his re-up in Milwaukee, it's really a year where there's not going to be a lot of guys that change scenes in the open market that do a whole lot to shift the tides. So getting Harden now and doing what they did essentially was a preemptive move for next year as well.
I agree with that.
Because there's a lot of things about that team that make me say, how does that work at the end of the line? For me, I could see them being a team that is a semifinalist team, you know, that gets to that point and has it happen. It's really, really hard for me in this very early junction of the season to say who actually is going to come out and who's going to do that. But boy, when I look at that team and I look at how it matches up, it would have some issues with the size of that Milwaukee team that's also got a little bit more cohesiveness and already has some of that experience together and getting over the hump. They've got a long way to come back right now. Both Toronto and Miami are going to be interesting matchups for that team if they both get to regular form. And then, of course, you've got the who right now seems to be a new man in Joel Embiid, who would just wreak havoc inside for that team because they've been left exposed under the rim.
And that, and also, I mean, look, DeAndre Jordan is still a fine player in the NBA, but he is not the DeAndre Jordan of old.
He's not going to stop Joel Embiid from doing what he's going to do, or Giannis, or Bam, or any of those.
And that underscores the other problem. The Nets can score out the yin yang, but they can't stop anybody. Mm-hmm. So I think that in itself, it's rare that a team with all this offensive power in any sport, to be honest with you, it's rare that a team with an insane amount of offensive firepower has enough defense to stop somebody to win, especially in a series. And I think that's the thing that holds the Nets back. And what will happen is either they make another move somewhere down closer to the trading deadline, which I think is hard because of all things they gave up, or hope that certain pieces fall in their direction in the offseason, in which they can find that defensive assistance, in which they can find even like people that can spell Durant. Because let's keep in mind, it's not so much about him being injured as much as just there's no depth behind Durant right now.
That's where you're going to feel the Dinwiddie loss. You know, that's where that's going to really step in at, because I mean, that was a big piece of their bench now, as far as from a talent standpoint, that's gone. There's some guys out there that make sense, but I don't think that they make dollars and cents. You know, imagine what a team like this would look like with trying to go out and rescue, say, a Andre Drummond, you know, who's in Cleveland, who's in the last year of a deal. Or if they would have been a team that would have been able to go out after like a Tristan Thompson or something like that. Like a guy that's a body that's going to do work in the middle, that would really be an interesting type of move for this team. But
yeah, especially with Drummond. I was going to say with Drummond, Drummond is not necessarily known as a defensive guy, but the thing is, because he is one of the best rebounders in the game, arguably the best at his position, you need to keep a body on him because he's going to get every single board possible.
Absolutely.
And that in itself, if somebody's stuck with, you know, dealing with him and keeping him away from the basket, that does help the other guys out defensively in terms of making the calls and all the stuff. Drummond would have been an ideal fit for that team.
Yeah.
But I don't think, especially with the money he's looking for after this contract, it may or may not happen in this way.
I don't think
I
don't think it happens in a free agent type of way. Unfortunately, in order to make the trade happen, they had to trade away one of the perfect guys for what their situation is now in Jared Allen, who's an underrated big in the league. Real quick,
and throw in the game. Best throw in sports right now.
One last question before we move past this. All things considered, all things being on the table, who got the most out of this trade between the four teams that were involved?
Ooh, that's tough, because initially, I actually thought Houston did. Not in the sense that, to me, it was getting the most out of it because it's over. The saga is over. And Steven Silas, first year head coach, he has a chance to build it to like really put his stamp on the team the way that he needs to. And I do think John Wall has been great after not playing for 2 years. John Wall has been outstanding to start the season. Mm-hmm. Having DeMarcus Cousins kind of getting his flow back is pretty nice for them as well. Christian Wood, man, that kid is good. He is really good. I think this allows them now to kind of run the way they want to in the long term. Now, this doesn't – even with Harden, this team was not going anywhere. So right now you can say, all right, well, if we're not going to go anywhere, at least we can – to the point that, you know, what Wall had said and what Cousins had said, you know, at the end of that infamous game against the Lakers, basically said, all right, if he doesn't want to be here, fine. We're here and we can run and we can build. And I think psychologically in the long run it does, you know, like at least right now it's going to be a big lift for Houston. In terms of talent, especially because it was a four-team trade and not a two-team trade, the Nets won because they still got the most talented player in the bunch and are going to be able to ascend at least and really contend for the Eastern Conference, even if they don't actually make it there. They can say they can contend for a couple of years, whereas Houston's not going to be able to do that. You know, Indiana, we'll see what happens with them because, you know, now they lost Oladipo and LeVert is out for the year because of the mass on his kidney.
Is LeVert out for the year because of that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He did say he's out for the year. They said I believe they said for the year, but let's assume for the year. You know, so that hurts a team that, you know, Oladipo was a really good player for them. But, you know, now you lost your starting guard and the guy that's supposed to replace him is not going to be there. So you're relying a lot more on Sabonis and Turner, who are good players.
but there's not enough.
Well, and you're without T.J. Warren at the moment. Right. You know, it just puts a lot of pressure on on Aaron Holiday, essentially, which is a pretty sizable step down there. All right, so we'll see. You know, I'll tell you what, having 8 draft picks and the trade chip that is Oladipo in the last year of his deal, that's pretty nice restart for a reboot. You know, I was sitting there thinking, I said, man, the only teams that are going to be drafted in like 2 years are going to be the Thunder and the Rockets, just going back and forth if they kept all the picks that they got right now. So we'll see where that goes. But while we're down in Houston on another part of the city in another league, boy, somebody has found themselves in – I didn't think it could get worse for the Texans than it was this year. But it's gone from critical to we're at the repass now, it feels like. I don't know where to start. You tell me where we start with this, and I'm sure we'll get to where we need to get to. Do we get to, the mismanagement of the – they've got a Pied Piper that's leading around their owner? Do we talk about Deshaun Watson channeling his very best James Harden in saying, it's over for me here? Or do we talk about how now that is without a doubt the worst possible open coaching vacancy in pro sports right now?
Well, to me, it goes back to, and it's very interesting you mentioned the Pied Piper out there, because obviously I'm thinking of, and I'm assuming you watched the show, The Great Silicon Valley that was on HBO. Yeah. And it feels... Honestly, so I was reading, it was great work on by Jenny Rentis at Sports Illustrated. I was reading those articles about the dysfunction in the Texas organization and reading about Jack Easterby. And I immediately thought of, anybody who watched Silicon Valley, the Houston Texans look very familiar. Mm-hmm. I know that they were described in the article. I know that they were talked about as more like Game of Thrones. But to me, what's happening with Carl McNair, he's got this spiritual advisor, this questionable spiritual advisor. To me, Carl McNair is Gavin. He is he really is. He is being led by a shaman who is honestly kind of defrauding him. But yet he still listens to him and knows that this is wrong, and yet still listens to him. Easterby really is like this. My God, I mean, we've been using the word grift a lot over the last 5 years because of the soon-to-be ex-president. But, man, what a grift. Because it doesn't make any sense to me how this man has been able to – you have no football experience. You have absolutely no football experience, and you are suddenly – you're not even – here's the crazy part. You're not even the son of the owner. Hi, Stephen Jones in the Dallas Cowboys. You're not even like related to the owner, and you were able to ascend to say, I'm going to make decisions of what this football team needs. He took religion and organizational behavior and desperation of football ownership and melded this into an incredible grift. That's what I took away from this whole thing. And the fact that it has affected the players the way it has, this isn't just about Deshaun Watson or J.J. Watt. This is about Andre Johnson, who isn't even involved in the organization like that anymore and was supposed to be helping with the search for the next head coach, saying, yeah, no, Easterby is a bad guy. He's not involved in the organization anymore. He may be the best player they've ever had. I know people say Watt. Andre Johnson might be the best player that franchise has ever had. And the fact that you alienated him so quickly, a young franchise, that says a lot about how bad things have gotten. When you have, the Jadeveon Clowney situation really goes back to Bill O'Brien, right? But it just tells you how toxic this organization is, in which the best, most talented players of the organization, who, if you built the right way, if you had the right coach and you had the right direction, the right ownership, they could have won the title or at least have gotten to the Super Bowl with the talent they've had in this franchise. Like, you think about all the guys that have been wasted in a 7-year period, right? Even before O'Brien got there, there were some issues with the organization because Bob McNair, I don't want to say rest in peace, but he wasn't exactly the best guy. He was a questionable character. And then you bring in O'Brien, and then you bring in Easterby, you bring in all these people who just – there's something in that water down there, man. It's just something's really bad. I don't know how else to describe it, but to me, this feels like an episode of Silicon Valley where the owner is being defrauded by somebody and continues to listen to him against all odds.
So now we're at a point now where you've got the guy who should be the one that you're hitching everything to, considering all that you've lost in that organization. You should be hitching any decision that you make. Not saying he should be making them, but saying that he should be a part of the process. Deshaun Watson. Now you've got him all but, I mean, and anybody who's anybody who knows a lot more than I do is saying it's over for him down there with how things have gone in that organization. It's an odd synchronicity that's happening right now. We see the Cleveland Browns pull themselves up by the rudders, reach the second round for the first time since 1969, and really become an organization that you're not really looking at anymore and saying there's some also-rans. You've got some hope with the New York Jets, although they definitely, you know, that's going to take some time to work out. But there's you can at least kind of see the pathway. Now, whether they follow it is a completely different thing. I would venture to say that the Houston Texans might be the worst run organization in professional sports right now with the way that things have worked out there.
I would agree with that because even my Knicks have figured out something. Even, you know, there are seven franchises at some point they figured something out. But, like, it's – what's a shame is Houston's a dope city, man. Houston has – and they will get behind you, and especially with football. Like, they want to get behind this franchise. They want to get – and especially with an MVP candidate in Watson. Like, what he did this year was phenomenal.
Yes.
All things considered, what he did was outstanding and completely wasted. If he had the right, and listen, let's not forget, you know, what happened with Hopkins, DeAndre Hopkins was just like disgusting. And I think people still, you know, people are still mystified how that happened. You know, but when you have a player of that caliber like Watson, who was able to put up these numbers without the offensive talents around him, and you have such disarray in all other parts of the organization, and a city that wants to get behind you, you're giving the city a reason to hate you. You're giving the season, you're giving the city almost a reason to say, man, I wish they never put a team here again, because if it's going to be this bad, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned the Browns couldn't get right once they came back into the league. They couldn't get right. And I still think they kind of fell into some luck this past year, this past season, this current season. But Cleveland wanted to get behind the Browns, and they were just so angered and so disgusted. You don't want – if you're a Houston Texans fan, do you want to wait 20 years for them to figure something out? And that's the danger here. I mean, the last time any football franchise has been this close, you know, with Houston, like, they haven't had a team that's gotten there before, you know? And then they went to see the Oilers – go to the other side of the country, essentially, and get to the Super Bowl. Get to play the greatest Super Bowl of all time, in my opinion, and get that close. But they couldn't see their Oilers do it. With this franchise, they're not – as it's run, they're not going to see the Texans do it. And it's going to be a long time before they get there. They're flirting with – to me, they're flirting with Detroit Lions territory if they don't get their things together. And that's – that's scary because McNair, you know, Carl McNair is not going to change. You know, he inherited from his dad. And so far, it seems as if they weren't going to do business any differently from what his dad did. So they're flirting with Lions territory. And that is something that they fans should be scared of.
So the tipping point in that entire thing is if everything that's been said, and we've seen bad situations that have turned around in one way or another in the past and not get as bad as they could have been with Deshaun Watson. Let's say that, you know, let's say that things don't get any better and a deal does have to get struck for him. First of all, what does that package look like if that happens? Because that is the trade that happens in every other sport, but it does not happen in football. Franchise quarterbacks that are pre-prime, Deshaun Watson is still pre-prime years of his career, just don't leave where they're at. I mean, I don't know. When is the last time? Maybe you can help me with this on recall. The last time that we saw a sub-27-year-old franchise quarterback change franchises?
When Drew Brees, when he left, I think he just hit 27.
Well, yeah, but when Drew Brees left, though, he left and became the man that he was going to be.
Right. He wasn't Drew Brees. No, he wasn't what we saw. No, absolutely. Yeah. But in terms of in retrospect, it's going to be seen. In retrospect, it's going to be seen that way if they make this, when they make this move out, because they kind of have to at this point. There's no reclamation. There's no reconciliation here. Like, it's just not happening. So it's going to be seen almost like that. But yeah, in terms of the history of the NFL, I'm hard pressed to think of something. And I will say this quickly: if you move Watson, you have to move Watt too.
Well, here's the thing. You see it early. You see the Brett Favre's, you know, young guy gets better. You know, you saw it with Steve Young. Young guy gets better. Drew Brees, injury. They gave up on him too soon. Young guy got a lot better. About 75,000 yards better. Yeah. You do not see this happen. You just don't see it happen. It's unprecedented. And some of the credit that I'm going to give because of it is to Deshaun Watson, who said no. I re-signed here with some promises that were in place, and you're going to honor them. Even if they're, if you want to call them as being unofficial or saying that, hey, you know, you get really close to the thing. And I can't remember who it was, if it was Randy Moss that said it last week. It said, we're past the shut up and play era. You're not going to be doing that anymore in the NFL at this point. I'm very fascinated in seeing what happens here, because there's a ton of teams that would make room for Deshaun Watson. There's also a ton of teams that have a need for Deshaun Watson. And I think that where he lands could shift the power structure in the NFL if it works out the right way.
Yeah, especially because, you know, the changing of the guard is almost complete in the NFL right now, where, you know, from what people have been saying and believing, it looks like Brees is going to hang it up. Tom Brady is going to be a cyborg. He's going to play until he's going to play until we're dead. But he's going to be playing somewhere, right? Aaron Rodgers, potentially the same thing, although I think he can probably decide at some point, like, you know what, I've done it all. I'm good. I'm a co-owner of the Milwaukee Bucks. I'm going to go ahead and count my money. Not co-owner, but part owner there. But, it's kind of interesting. Like, we have Mahomes now. This is the period the NFL has been waiting for a while. They've been waiting to see if they can get these young, dynamic quarterbacks and of different talent. I mean, not different talent, but like different styles, different manners, different everything spread around the league. And the movement of Watson puts a massive hole in what happens in the state of Texas with football, because also, you know, the Cowboys right now, you know, they're going to see if Dak Prescott's going to kind of get back in gear. First of all, they got to sign the guy and see what happens there. Like, there's now, you're moving Watson. There's not a whole lot to look forward to when it comes to football in the state of Texas right now. And so any return that they get has to be like years worth of returns. We're talking about, I don't know, at least 2 years of first round picks, second round picks involved, because also we got to, you know, keep the money in mind as well. You also have to give them at least, a defensive player of renown. You have to give them some. You have to the package.
They've got to go get a quarterback back. You've got to get some version of a quarterback.
But they're not going to get a quarterback back. You know, like you think they would, but they're not going to get a quarterback in the same caliber that can kind of get things running.
Well, no. The way in my mind, the only way to get a quarterback of the same caliber would be to trade for somebody like Josh Allen or Lamar Jackson or something like that.
Good luck with that.
And like we said before, that just doesn't happen. However, there are
They still don't have a head coach, which means they still don't know what their philosophy is going to be next season.
Yes.
So then that makes the question of who will be the quarterback under center there even more important, when you have to have a head coach who decides what direction they're going to go offensively.
And here's the thing I wanted to say about that, though, because I did want to get to that point as well, because I think that that's the I think that's kind of the eight ball in the mix. But the thing I'll say is that The complicated thing here is that you just can't pack Deshaun's bags and send them anywhere.
No, you can't. And that's what makes this really interesting. Like, I don't know what they can do. I really don't.
Well, I'll tell you what you can do. And it's one of the hearsay things that you hear up front, but one of the things that might not be too crazy of an idea. What about a trade with picks? A team that has a lot of them in the Miami Dolphins, and a guy like Tua Tagovailoa. I struggle with his name for some reason.
I do too.
Those words.
But I do think, I mean, I think that's why that play is being talked about as much as it is, because it seems as if he's on the ascendance, if you will. He's a guy that, you know, maybe you build around him because or have him start over because you start over with him because he's just getting himself going. Mm-hmm. He just got in the league. And so he's not going to be as hardened to a system if he was being just finishing his rookie year as he would have if he traded a guy who was in his fifth or sixth year, who's gotten used to an offensive system. And so I think that would be – it seems like the most logical play to make. And then Miami still has to make sure they do their part to keep Watson happy. Because that's the other thing too. Like, in terms of the trade partner, Watson's going to need some pieces to come with him too. Like, he's going to need pieces to come to him as well to make this worthwhile. So – you know, it's going to be interesting to sort of see what happens here. Matt, we got to pause. I got to get the kid.
Now. All right, welcome back in to Sports Scenario. Hey, real quick, right before we took that quick break, we were talking about Deshaun Watson, talking about some different things that some different options and places that this could work out at. There are a couple of things that came to mind for me. Obviously, there's the tricky thing in trading a quarterback salary that we never see, you know? So it's like, how do you work that out? What does that look like? So a couple of destinations that popped up to me real quick outside of Miami, which was the first thing that was talked about because of Deshaun's interest that could be there. But a couple of other places, if he's willing to let his no trade clause go, could be interesting. Just let me know what you think about them. If you got a couple, I will return the courtesy. The Los Angeles Rams. The Los Angeles Rams have a similarly priced quarterback, and I begin to get vibes that they're not as pleased with Jared Goff as they could be. Let me put it this way. They're not necessarily getting back the bang for the buck.
No, not at all. Not at all. And even though, yeah, they got to the Super Bowl a couple years ago, it's definitely the return is not that strong. And I do think, and you want to talk about wasting the prime of a career, you know, and the way people talk about J.J. Watt right now, you're potentially wasting a Hall of Famer's career in Aaron Donald. So if there's a quarterback who can actually kind of get him back to the Super Bowl and potentially win it, it would be Deshaun Watson, for sure.
For sure. And I think that that would be something that from a salary standpoint can make sense. You know, the Rams have shown that they're not against trading picks and definitely not against picking up big salary that's there while you're going to be looking to open up, you know, if you will, SoFi Stadium finally when people are allowed to come in. What a better way to do it than to have a guy like Deshaun Watson on board. Another place that could be interesting, the New Orleans Saints. They've got some questions ahead of them, even with Drew Brees, you know, regardless. What did you see in the divisional series? They brought in a guy that could throw the ball downfield and they scored. I mean, that was just what it looked like. And Deshaun Watson can do that. It would be a dynamic offense, to say the least, with him. And again, when you look at a guy like Brees and the money that he was making, it could make sense. They could make that work from a cap standpoint too.
Yeah, I think it also gives, you know, it keeps a guy like Michael Thomas, you know, supposed to be considered one of the best in the league and all this stuff, you know, up there in his prime and making sure that he still can produce. I do think there obviously would be questions about what do they do. You know, I think it'd be questions about, you know, bringing him on means other people got to go. Do they maintain some sort of defensive competence, you know, and all that as well to make the money work? That remains to be seen, but I do think that's something that New Orleans should definitely entertain, especially the possibility that Brees does hang it up at some point and frees up some money. I think that'd be an interesting destination. I'll throw this out there for you. Minnesota. I'll throw that out there because I'm very interested in seeing what you think about, you know, potentially sending Watson up to Minnesota. Yeah, I see you frozen.
Yeah, I stopped for a second there. Sorry for the interruption there. Let's run back real quick. Sure. Just go back to Minnesota. Yeah, just start saying, over from right there. We'll get this out.
Yeah, I was saying, like, you know, we're talking about teams that, you know, he could potentially step in right away and, you know, keep the offense humming. And that's why I kind of wonder, what about a team like Minnesota? Franchise-wise, you know that Minnesota is not averse to having, you know, black quarterbacks that can sling the rock. You know, and that's how
No. That's worked out well for them.
Yeah, but I do think it's meaningful there too. You know, I'm not just tossing out there just because of you know, Kirk Cousins not that good of a quarterback, but which is true. But I do think also, you know, Minnesota is a franchise that this isn't like a complete acclimation of that, you know. And I do think that they've they've had some of their best seasons under guys that can really sling that pill. And the guys who've been like that, Randall Cunningham and Dante Culpepper. We know that Watson can do it. He put up MVP kind of numbers. And a franchise like Minnesota, which is – they're frozen. And I do think if they were able to keep a guy – listen, Stephon Diggs, we see what he's been able to do. He's a leading receiver this season with Buffalo. Imagine if somehow, some way, they were able to retain him and then get rid of Kirk Cousins in order to bring in a guy like Watson. Oh, my goodness. How dynamic that could have been.
Well,
but then, in turn, they don't have Diggs up there. So it's like, what can you do?
Well, I mean, you don't have Stephon Diggs, but you do have Justin Jefferson. And Justin Jefferson, yeah, I think, has every bit of the level of upside that Stephon Diggs had. And he could easily be that same type of player. That's interesting. It's an interesting move. The Cousins deal kind of complicates it. But, I mean, I could definitely see that, you know, anything's possible if it's there. For some reason, I don't see Deshaun, who's from South Carolina and is living in Texas, wanting to move to Minnesota and would be willing to waive his trade clause to go up there. But who knows? I don't know a ton of brothers that say I want to be in Minnesota until the check is being cashed there.
And that's true. But the thing is, I do think there's something to be said about the coaching up there. I mean, Mike Zimmer is respected. And I think that does matter. It's not just about – for a guy like Watson, it's not just about, yeah, like where I'm going to be comfortable. And I'm sure that's going to be the case. You can look at a lot of the southern cities and all that stuff. But I do think coaching competence actually matters to him. Seeing how dysfunctional things got in his time in Houston, I think – and there's some relative stability up there in Minnesota. And these franchises – look, I look at the Rams, right? You know, we talk about the Rams just now. The Rams, to me, feel like a consultancy rather than a football team. It feels like they're a franchise that's – you know, we see with the coaching, like they're just grabbing guys here and they're grabbing whatever they want. There's nothing, for as talented as they are, there's nothing stable there. And yeah, he would bring in a little bit more stability and a lot more talent under center and a lot more success potentially. But there's such a, for a franchise that has the resources, they're not solid to me. Whereas I look at Minnesota, and again, they're not great, but I do think that he would definitely command. Yeah, I do think a guy like Zimmer, and if they make changes later on, I do think that he's looking for somewhere with where he can truly respect the coaches. He could respect some sort of stability, whereas he's been seeing so much instability in Houston. I think it's not just about the market. It's not just about, you know, being somewhere warm or stuff like that. It is about being able to go to an organization and say, like, hey, you've done something here in this league, and you have something that I can learn from. And I do think that there's something there in some of these other places that may not exist right now in Houston.
The thing I'll say about it is, and then we can kind of turn into when we're talking about this topic here, is that it seems like what Deshaun wanted was a fair amount of insight into the who's going to be calling the shots, you know, and I think understandably so. He understood the position that he was in. He understood that he was the centerpiece of the organization, that he was making a long-term commitment at a time where there wasn't a whole lot of certainty about what that meant with the Houston Texans. That's what I think is part of what plays the interest into Miami. I think he sees that it's a young team that's coming up. You've got a guy in Brian Flores down there who certainly has been a part of the successful organization and can provide that stability and that guidance. You know, so and then on top of that, it's Miami. It's Miami.
Oh, for sure.
You know, at the end of the day, he's going to make more of that contract in Miami than he would in anywhere else. I mean, Texas is a place Absolutely. Where he's going to get a lot of it. Vegas would be an awesome place for Deshaun Watson, but they're not going to be moving on from Derek Carr at the moment. But he would eat a lot of that contract in Vegas too because of the tax stuff. There's a lot of reasons why so many guys flock to Florida, you know, and sure. That's it. But I also think that Deshaun is smart enough to know that the right coach in the right situation has to be at hand. And that's one thing I wanted to hit before we moved away from the NFL in full is it's kind of ironic to be having this conversation. We're recording this on MLK Day. So some things could change, you know, since we started recording the show, I did see that maybe even the Washington Redskins are getting ready. I'm sorry, the Washington football team.
It's hard sometimes. Listen, we know.
I don't like, yeah, I'll put it this way. I don't like either name. So I think that they're both, I almost, this is probably the wrong thing to say. I almost dislike Washington football team even more because it's throwing your nose up at why you needed to change the name. But that's a whole other thing. That's a whole nother thing. The Washington Professional Football Team of the greater D.C. area might be moving to bring in the old Panthers GM, Marty Yeah, Marty Herney might be coming in to be the GM there, following Ron Rivera over that way. Nothing inspires me about that move, but whatever. This is where we're at. But I will say that I have been extraordinarily, not just uninspired, but also not let down by the lack of diversity that has come from this year's coaching search in the NFL. You know, we came into the offseason with 13 openings between head coach and between general manager. To date, we have 3 minority hires. Brad Holmes coming over from the Rams, where he was the director of scouting, is going to be the GM in Detroit. You've got Terry Fontenot, who's director of scouting in New Orleans. He's going to be the GM in Atlanta. But then you only have Robert Saleh, who is the who's going to, and this is of note, the first Muslim Lebanese head coach in NFL history, which is fantastic, because I think that's an area of society that you don't traditionally look at for football knowledge and things of that nature to come from, a lot of football talent and things. But Saleh has certainly earned his right to be the next coach of the Jets. However, there's something very, very large missing there. And we still do not have a pathway for there to be substantial growth in the area of African-American coaches in the NFL. And if things stay the way they are today, 2 of the 32 jobs in the NFL are inhabited by African-Americans.
Which is crazy.
So I'll throw this to you. Coming out of 2020 and all the things we saw, and all of the calls for movement, and some of the legitimate movement that we saw in across the pro sports world, I think that everybody, and I know you're not outside of this group, very many people looked at the NFL and said, you're doing just enough to get by. Let's see you step up when it really counts. Well, now is finally that time, and not only are they not stepping up, they're falling back.
Not surprised. I mean, to be honest with you, I tend to not be surprised by anybody sort of falling back. The NFL, and that's part of the reason why I made that comment about the Rams in particular, reminded me of like McKinsey or, Accenture, stuff like that, consultancy firms that just happens to be a football team. Sean McVay, offensive genius and all that stuff, obviously, white coaches always get the label of being a genius, right? Offensive geniuses. That's always been the case. But it's been interesting that like the guys that get plucked are guys who never really ran a full unit as a coordinator and all that, right? Mm-hmm. And the guys have been plucked out of the Rams over the last couple of years are more or less, it's like they're, I'm here for the job. I'm going to go somewhere else. I worked under this guy who's supposed to be a genius who went to the Super Bowl. And let's see if that genius rubs off of me, right? And that's always been the case. Like, let's see if this genius rubs off of me in some ways. That's why you talk about the coaching trees the way we do. But it's been very interesting to see the last couple of years, the guys who've ascended, the guys who've not been, not all, obviously, but Joe Judge here in the metropolitan area, taking over for the Giants. He was never a coordinator here in the NFL. Eric Bieniemy, they say, people have debated if he actually ran the offense or not. And truth is, no. He ran that offense to a plum. Obviously, with Andy Reid, he's learned from that tree as well. But it's like that guy still can't get an opportunity. And it's been really frustrating to see these different coaches getting plucked out of nowhere. Like, I think it was a New Orleans tight ends coach just got hired for one of these jobs. Like
the assistant head coach for New Orleans, it's Dan Campbell, just got the Lions job last
night. And listen, Dan Campbell was in the league as a player for a while. He's a respected tight end and all this stuff. So I'm sure that he's going to get some attention. He's going to bring a lot more respectability than Matt Patricia did. I'm not even disputing what he can do. But it's been interesting where I think maybe because he got that associate head coach or assistant head coach label, that probably made up for the lack of coordinator title. And I'm very interested in sort of seeing like if that's what's going to happen, if that's what some of these black aspiring future head coaches are going to have to do. If they have to say, well, I'm not going to be a coordinator, I'm going to be an assistant and then go for this other title or whatever else in order to show that I have the mentality. Like, do they have to play with their resumes a little bit more? You know what I mean? Like,
here's the problem, the labels though.
A little bit. That's just killing me right now about what's happening. It's like you're now skipping guys who've had years, who have resumes, who have the respect of their – not just their peers, but the respect of the players that they're working with and who have ascended on those trees. And you're even overlooking that now? Like, that's insane.
So here's the big problem I have. And this is going to be around Eric Bieniemy. Eric Bieniemy has been by and far, maybe with the exception of Urban Meyer, the biggest name that has been around any of the coaching jobs that have landed this year. You know, Robert Saleh made his name last year helping the 49ers get to the Super Bowl. Has certainly shown what he can do with that unit. Had some shining moments for that unit this year while it was drastically undermanned. I mean, he has certainly earned his way up the pathway that's there. Arthur Smith in Tennessee, you know, showed that, you know, yeah, he could turn around a quarterback in Ryan Tannehill. And one thing that we know in the NFL that will always get you another job is being able to show that you can get the most out of the quarterback position. That will always get you a job because it's the biggest investment. And it certainly draws the line towards where the success is at. If you look at the teams that are in the conference championships this upcoming weekend, look at the position. It ain't running backs that got them there. It is Aaron Rodgers. It is Pat Mahomes. It is Josh Allen. It is Tom Brady. That is the difference between the fortunes of all of those franchises. However, you know, you have Brandon Staley, who had a great year as DC with the Rams, staying in town, moving over to the Chargers. That's fine. But what more does Eric Bieniemy have to do? And beyond that point, why is the conversation just around Eric Bieniemy? It's not like he's the only African American coach who could be qualified to make such a jump. The defense in Tampa is led by Ty Bowles. They won that game last night.
And he should have a chance. And to that point, Todd Bowles has earned a chance to get a second chance. And that's the other thing too, right? But I think the reason why the conversation is around Bieniemy as much as it has been is because this goes to, you know, you mentioned the importance of a quarterback, right? Well, this goes to the history of the black athlete in the NFL, where you weren't thought of to be smart enough to be a part of an offense outside of being a receiver or a running back, right? So you weren't smart enough to be a quarterback. Okay, well, we proved that we could be smart to be quarterbacks. Well, are you smart enough to be an offensive coach? And I think that's the hurdle right now. You know, most of the black head coaches in the history of the NFL have had a defensive background. It's been very rare that you've seen a black coach with an offensive background. And that's why it's centered around Bieniemy as much as it is. I mean, look, in a couple of years, the conversation could be around Byron Leftwich, right? Byron Leftwich, former NFL quarterback, offensive coordinator with Tampa Bay right now. He could be the next guy that gets some sort of conversation, right? That he may be the next Bieniemy, right? We don't know. And as for the fact that we've been stuck with looking at black coaches from a defensive point of view and never really giving that offensive shot. And so the conversation is going to be, hey, listen, this is the best way we can prove our equality, which is right here. The places where you thought we weren't smart enough to be, well, we're dominating here too. And listen, Bieniemy and Reed have helped make Patrick Mahomes give him the biggest contract in sports history. I think that should say a lot to what Bieniemy can actually do.
Yeah, it goes into the thing where I say that the talent of the quarterback should never be assumed to just purely be the reason that the quarterback has success. Patrick Mahomes has an innate abilities to do things that just few people ever born can do at quarterback. But he also landed in a pretty nice position with Andy Reid being there, and also with Eric Bieniemy, who was underrated until people started looking at what Pat Mahomes could do.
You can't forget the impact of Alex Smith. You know, he the tutelage of Alex Smith for that, you know, for the brief period of time they were together. Smith had been there, done that. He was able to learn from that a little bit more too. So that definitely helped.
Makes a difference. I want to go back to one thing that you said there real quick before we turn out of this conversation. Leslie Frazier in Buffalo, he's going to be coaching in the AFC Championship game this weekend. Mm-hmm. What's his title? I'm going to tell it to you. It was a retort. Right. It's assistant head coach.
Yeah.
So if that's the qualifier, and that's somebody who's helping one of these teams go on one of the runs it's on right now, a guy that's been in the seat before and has earned his way back into that conversation, then prove it. There's two teams left on the board that can do it. I heard that the Philadelphia Eagles are going to be looking at inviting Josh McDaniels to come to town, who could be the guy, who could be a guy who is like, all right, now if I'm going to do it, it's time, because I might not get another call. But there's
two. And then, listen, oh God, I'm sorry. The McDaniels thing is frustrating because it's like, he's really going to get another call, especially after backing out of Indianapolis. At this point, like, it's 32 head coaching jobs. You actually had the job and you said no.
Like, but this goes back into the inequity thing. But he got a call again. He got a call again this year after seeing what that offense was, and you took all the bells and whistles out of it. There was nothing impressive about that offense this year. There was nothing special about that Broncos offense when he was over it. There was nothing special about that Rams offense when he was over it either. But he gets the call, and just happens that a couple of hours ago, the Texans finally said that they're interviewing Eric Bieniemy today.
Yeah, because okay. They got that. Yes. That to me is a PR thing with the yes. Texans. I'm yes. sorry.
That's a,
I don't think anybody really believes
that. That's a PR thing. But all things being said equal, there's still the NFL dropped the ball in a major way in an offseason that, to me, it looks like at the very most, we're going to be staying in place with black leadership in the sport.
They're staying in place in general. This is what they are. This is what they do. This is honestly the case of most sports leagues. You know, they want to show something for PR purposes. They don't want to get pillared. But then, you know, give it a few months, it'll go back to normal. That's what they do.
So while we're talking about diversity moments here, one thing that I do want to hit on real quick, I think this is a bigger conversation, and it's one that we most certainly will have to open up the books for in a wider sense at some point down the road. Major League Baseball, however, is not striking out with diversity. At a time when the game is still underserved with African-American players, the ones that are there are doing everything possible that they can to make sure that their presence is felt, not just on the field, but in the community as well. You know, I think that, you know, Doug Glanville, ex-MLB outfielder, spent some time on ESPN, adding a lot of insight there to the game, dropped a really, really great look into the duality of what it means to be a African-American looking at the coaching ranks in Major League Baseball today. But also seeing that the value for him at this time right now is more towards serving home and what it means to be a black man, both in and out of the sport. It's a piece that I really would encourage a lot of people to look at, but I also would encourage a lot of people to look at the duality and the presence that African-Americans are taking in baseball right now. Because I feel like while we're still looking to get the numbers up in that sport, that I don't know if I can ever recall a time where the responsibility has been held up to a higher standard than it is right now to lead and to be visible by African-Americans in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I read the piece as well from Glanville. First of all, I mean, I've always appreciated Glanville's insights. You know, he's somebody who, you know, he's always been, obviously, you know, he's a cerebral guy. That's how you become an analyst. That's how you become the person he's become. You know, he's a very cerebral person, very thoughtful, very insightful about his position in the game, where he belongs, not just as an analyst or as an aspiring manager, but just his place in general. I always thought he was very insightful in that, saying he may have not been a star player per se, but he had a voice that he has tried to use, you know, working with the Players Union for quite a while, you know, in sort of an executive role when he was a player. He's always been somebody who just had that sort of greater insight than just, I'm just a guy who's just trying to collect a check and hit a ball, you know? So I've always appreciated that. There were two things to me in the piece that stood out. One, what was interesting was, you know, he talked about his credentials, you know, and he has just about every credential you could think of, including the one that seems to be the next hurdle for a lot of aspiring black managers in baseball, which is he graduated from an Ivy League school. The fact that, you know, the game is being run by analytic guys who have the Ivy League degrees. Well, as a former player, he's one of the few that actually has an Ivy League degree, and yet he still isn't considered a serious candidate, except for the position he spoke of when he interviewed the Tampa Bay Rays back in 2014, which I don't think that would have been the best sort of situation for him anyway. And I think he may have agreed with that. But it's interesting. He's a guy who came together with all the credentials and knew that it was still, you know, a bigger mountain for him to climb than somebody who went to a Sloan conference back in 2013. You know what I mean? And that in itself is kind of offensive and maddening. Like, yeah. You have guys who just, you know, brown nose their way into a couple conferences and suddenly get like an assistant to the assistant general manager position for a Major League Baseball franchise. Are you kidding me? This is a guy who played in the league for 10 plus years, solid career, well respected, had that bigger credential of having that degree, and was not going to get all the conversations with the decision makers of Major League Baseball teams. And that kind of got to me because it made me think in a different way about, well, you and me as media professionals and, you know, the stuff that we have to do in order to sort of make our voices heard and that make ourselves known. And yet it still won't be heard loud as sort of the mediocre white dudes that make bad media. You know, it reminded me of that. But the second thing that kind of got my attention is, you know, him speaking as a dad. And I'm not one to talk very often about, you know, my personal life these days, but, you know, I'm a black guy that is raising a black son as well. And I'm starting to think a lot more about that, than I ever had before. Now, my son is 2 years old. So there's still a lot of time until I can have those big conversations, but the conversations aren't that far away. I have to start thinking about that more in the way that my parents thought about it for me and my five siblings and my nieces and nephews. You know, and it's that resonated with me as well. And in this era where, you know, he said, I have to think about these conversations about the protest, about police brutality, about inequities and all that stuff. And I have to have these conversations with my kids because they're old enough to sort of ask those questions. I'm like, damn, like that time is going to be sooner for me than I would have expected. And I don't know if I have an intellectual sort of thing to follow up with that about, but well, those are two things that resonated with me. It's like that period is kind of close for me.
Here's the thing that I'll say about black management in baseball. And when you talk about calling out inequities, since Cito Gaston became the first African-American manager to win a World Series back in 1992, there've been 11 black managers, 11.
Yeah.
Right now,
2021.
We just got the 11th one last year in Dave Roberts. Right now, there are two black managers in all of baseball with Roberts and then Dusty Baker, who just happened to get back in the game because there was a reclamation project in Houston. And Dusty just happened to be the type of veteran guy that you want to bring back in. And lo and behold, Dusty got that team together, got them within a game of returning right back to the World Series. You know why? Because Dusty Baker is a hell of a manager, and he has been for years.
One of the greatest, and should be in the Hall of Fame, hopefully.
Well, but here's the challenge that I have with that, though. We're also in an era where you see guys that are 38 years old, 39 years old, just retired, you know, that from the game, that are managers. You know, your guys like your Rocco Baldellis. And, you know, you see guys that just recently retired not too long ago, like a Kevin Cash or somebody like that, get back into
David Ross.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, and you see them get right back into the game that quickly. Meanwhile, when was the last time that we had a young, exuberant black male be a Major League Baseball manager?
I don't know the time that's happened.
I don't recall it at all.
I don't think it's happened. Not for black managers, no. And I will say for minority managers, though, we've seen Alex Cora, which is actually, and it's actually kind of cool that he actually goes right back to Boston. It's like, oh, okay, Boston's like, listen, no. You're still great for us. Come back home.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it could have been Carlos Beltran, unfortunately. That didn't work out for him. But, like, you know, it's not that it doesn't happen for minorities, but you're right. Like, for a black man, for a black former player to go right into management, that doesn't happen. I mean, maybe the last time was, like, I don't know, Frank Robinson? And how many years ago was that?
Yeah, I mean, that exactly. I mean, and then you see guys that have no past experience in the role. I mean, I say here in St. Louis, Mike Matheny took over a team and had never managed ever. You know, but, I mean, you don't see that happening for black players, and that's a shame. It just shows
the closest thing.
I want to finish that thought real quick. Is that it shows to me that the tides don't all come in at the same height. No. I mean, and there's no other denying about it. But I also know, and these are from conversations I've had personally, that it doesn't happen for a lack of interest in continuing in the game from black players.
No, far from that.
But it comes from a lack of activity on their phone line. And it's just calling it what it is.
Well, listen, I think it was Howard Bryant, the great Howard Bryant, that had, this is a larger issue with baseball management, right? When it comes to everything under the Rob Manfred umbrella over the last few years that has happened with the game in terms of this Bain Capital sort of approach to the game, right? Where it's tear everything down, make everything as cost efficient as possible, and just get guys who can just run the ship. Like just run the Excel spreadsheet.
Stuff a jersey and we'll put the paper into it that you stuff it with.
And I think with that mentality, and especially those of us who may have worked in, like, you know, larger corporate environments before, when you see that sort of mentality pervade a company, it allows for the blind spots that previously existed to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think with the diversity issue, and listen, I knew some people who were close to the main offices here in New York. The diversity thing was not something that was on Manfred's agenda. Not that he's not calling him racist or anything like that, not even close. But that wasn't the focus. And it's a surface level focus, if you will, under the Manfred regime. And I think, again, like any other company, when all of a sudden they bring in the consultants or they bring in like just this sort of different management style, you know, the things that matter, the soft skills that matter to an organization, the communication methods, the company culture of like how people get along and all this stuff. And which also talks about diversity in terms of gender, race, religion, all this stuff. That stuff can be pushed to the wayside as long as an organization is looking for how do we maximize the most amount of money possible without spending it. And I think what happens with what's happening in baseball right now is the same thing. And so they're not going to get they're going to continue to get called out for the diversity issues more and more. But the large issues that baseball is being called out for is about the economic issues, or rather for the issues they're creating themselves, the problems they're creating themselves. And so therefore, the diversity thing is going to get kicked down the can again and again. And again, because it's not the focus of the organization overall. It's not the focus of Major League Baseball right now. It should be, especially because, again, there are young, talented Black players who are coming into the game and who are starting to make a name for themselves and are starting to help bring that buzz, the youthful buzz that baseball has been needing for years. But the organization of Major League Baseball, the business, the management, they don't give a damn. What's it going to take for them to give a damn? Maybe they need a real-life Jim Brockmeyer to come in. I mean, I don't really know what's going to take for them to figure this out. Maybe they – and unfortunately, you know, maybe the situation with the Houston Astros and Dusty Baker is what it's going to take. Maybe it is going to be you have to hit rock bottom. You have to do what us Black folks have always known, which is when the organization screws up or when the country screws up, that's when you bring in the Black guy. And unfortunately, it seems like that's what it's going to take for them to figure this out. Maybe it's at the commissionership. Maybe it's at, you know, top executive levels. Maybe it is just ownership, because we don't have any ownership in baseball like that. But it's probably going to take some extreme drastic measure for baseball to realize they're screwing this up in order for them to actually try to get right. And by then, who knows if it'd be too late.
Well, it's going to take a lot more than Jackie Robinson days and integrating the Negro Leagues into the history books, which is something I'm going to save for a much bigger conversation the next time we get together. But it's going to take a lot more than that for the representation to truly be there. And I would just say that, you know, consider the whole field. Don't just look at parts of it. All right, man, before we get out of here today, I want to leave something on your lap that I just, as soon as I saw it, I said, well, there's only one person on earth that I want to share this news with. And this came to us courtesy of the good folks at TMZ. Charles Barkley, a personal favorite of yours, I know for sure, it said that NBA players should skip the line for the COVID-19 vaccine on the basis that, well, they pay more taxes. I'm going to give a quote here real quick, and then I'll hand it over to you. And this also came up with Kenny Smith, who disagreed with him pretty quickly. But also we'll go with this first. You know, we need 300 million shots. Give 1,000 to some NBA players, NFL players, hockey players. You know, as much taxes as these guys pay, they deserve some preferential treatment.
You know, when I was a kid, Charles Barkley was one of my favorite players. Actually, the first sports jersey I ever bought was the Phoenix alternate black jersey, a Charles Barkley jersey, okay. Because they also ran out of the Patrick Ewing jersey at the store I was going to. So I got that one. It was dope, right? But as a player, I loved him, even though he was a flawed player. As a person, I knew there were questions, but I was a kid. I was a teenager. Like, what was I thinking? And as I got older, it's just like, shut the fuck up. that's it. Just shut the fuck up. That's in an era in which we don't want athletes sticking to sports, this is somebody who needs to. He has proven for close to 20 years now that it's not that he doesn't get it, he doesn't want to get it. And
And I think that
I get angry. I just make sure.
Well, that's what. Hey, man, this isn't SportsCenter. This isn't the sports reporters. Say whatever the fuck you want to here.
No, listen. Okay, so let me take us back to our days with the Sports Fan Journal when we were, you know, really doing it, right? A big shout out to one of my favorite people in the world, Rosalind Ross. Rosalind Ross, who is out there doing her thing as an actress right now, representing the great city of Memphis, Tennessee. One of the first pieces that she actually did with us, one of the first things I noticed about her when she was writing before she got on the CSFJ, was a piece she did about Charles Barkley. And she just went, it's exact about every single thing that he said. I think this was a time in which he was really beefing with DeMarcus Cousins. And she just kind of went point for point about, like, you know, yeah, you're somebody who probably needs to just stop it, right? But that was like the latest in a string of controversies with him and his mouth. And I think back to her piece because we thought that had been the time in which it would be over, in which it was like, all right, maybe he'll finally get a clue. And he never did. He then got in trouble with more alcohol, and all of a sudden he got in all sorts of stupid issues. There was the infamous thing with, like, you know, driving over with, you know, back home in the Phoenix area where he's trying to get a blowjob from some chick or whatever. It was just the stupid shit that he did. And you would think that every single time that there would be something that would get him, because we black folks were not happy with him. And the NBA, and in particular the NBA on TNT, does rely heavily on the black audience, right? You would think that would be the point. It's just as you got to stop. And he never did. I don't trust anybody. I don't trust somebody who tells like it is, because usually they don't. They're lying about something. They're full of shit about something. And he truly has been that for a very long time. He's a guy, even based on his own work as an analyst, is not a good analyst. So I'm not going to expect him to be very good in terms of taking issues outside of the sports world. And outside of voting for, pushing the Doug Jones campaign a few years ago for Senate, he hasn't necessarily done anything that has been worthwhile publicly in terms of, you know, his support for, you know, social justice or just social anything. He's never been that great at it. I'm getting so frustrated talking about this now. And I'm frustrated because he's a guy who's taken up so much attention. He takes up so much bandwidth. He makes a lot of money from Turner/Warner/AT&T, whatever the fuck you want to call the company now that I used to work for. He has that prominent place in sports media, and he has been using it and abusing it in ways that are egregious, disrespectful, and just flat out dumb. And the fact that nobody has just put him out to pasture yet has been abhorrent.
Well,
I don't know anybody else. He is the white men of black sports analysts. Like, he really is. He's gotten away with so much crap.
I would say that he's the light. The Jason Whitlock's not letting him have that title outright. So
it's No. And that's true. But the thing is, I think a lot of people also really don't know who the hell Jason Whitlock is in comparison to Charles Barkley.
Unfortunately, some of the most ignorant things happen outside of the mainstream sight lines, but then they become big issues and everybody pays attention to it. Charles Barkley is the inverse of that. Real quick, I want to bring you back before we end this thing because I know where that sits.
Happy times, please.
Son, awesome commercial for the upcoming NASCAR season with a shout out and then a new team from North Carolina.
Yes.
And you have the 23 card doing
that. Was dope. I saw that yesterday and I was like, yo, I'm actually kind of hyped for this. Like,
it's one of those triggers. It's one of those generational triggers. Anytime that you say from North, Carolina, I say, okay, see, they knew what they were doing right there. They're gonna get me to watch for that reason alone.
It was well played. And by the way, I think Pitbull's about to join NASCAR as well. I think he put in some money to a team. I forgot which team it is.
I love it. The spice is crazy. Let's have every holiday, diversity day, put it in NASCar. You guys don't get a reprieve. We're coming there too. So let's make NASCAR look like Joe Biden's cabinet. Let's do that. Let's make
it work. I'm fully with it, man.
Jason, let people know where they can hit you up at, man. Share anything you want to share.
Twitter.com/asportscribe, A-S-P-O-R, but I can't even spell anymore. Asportscribe, put the words together. It's just one word, no spaces. There you go. That's on Twitter and on Instagram. And I don't want to say anything just yet because it's still in development, but there is something new that some of us are working on. And I think we're pretty excited stay tuned. That's as much as I can say. I haven't really been hyping to talk about it yet because, you know, you don't want to jinx it. But I'm excited for the next step.
There's a whole new thing coming soon. Yeah. Take note. Jay, I appreciate you being available, brother. And hey, everybody, I appreciate y'all tuning in for the episode. As always, you can catch us and every other show that is on the network at SOLC Network on Facebook. You can check out every single individual Instagram feed we've got. We'll always source things back through SOLC Network on IG as well. This week coming up, go back and we just dropped yesterday a new episode of Politics as Usual with DeMarco Davis and Chris Carter, touching on a wide range of topics there. Go back in the show before that. Listen to the episode that we had with Michael Butler, who's the leader of the Democratic Party here in the state of Missouri. Very interesting conversation with him about the Josh Hawley situation and all the other things that have blown up
sorry
the area. We also have coming up later on this week new episode of The Scenario, regular scenario, outside of this one, and we also have a brand new episode of We Coming For You with the homeboys breaking down wrestling and only
greatest title ever.
So
the greatest title ever, man.
The ultimate inside joke that's outside. But hey, this is Matt Whitener again. Thanks to Jason Clean Scales for joining us, and we will check you again next week on The Sports Scenario. Peace.
Later.